We are past 7:30, so I think we should go ahead and get started. Welcome all to members and guests, any guests that we have with us. Guests, as always, are welcome. If you want to join, we'd be happy to have you join our happy little band. So tonight is our May meeting, general meeting, and we're going to have our members' favorite, which is a perennial favorite. Lots of people find these presentations to be quite interesting and useful. So tonight we're going to have four presentations. Thank you to those who volunteered to put together these presentations on things that they find nifty and think that maybe you'll find useful as well. Our presenters tonight are going to be Tom Trottier, Stuart Bruce, Alan German, and myself. I am now going to mute all, and you will not have the ability to unmute yourself. So if you have any comments or questions, please feel free to use the chat, or we will open up the microphones in between each presentation for a short Q&A. So each of the presentations is going to be 10 to 20 minutes long, and so hopefully we will be wrapping up on time by 9 o'clock this evening. So without anything else there, I think that we'll turn it over to our first presenter, which is Tom Trottier. And Tom, take it away. And you'll have to unmute yourself.
He unhinged himself.
I can ask you to unmute.
No, I don't think he's there.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, there he is.
I'm here.
Yes, great. You're here. Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Okay, I think I'm sharing my screen. Am I, does it say portable apps and stuff like that?
Yep.
Okay, folks. So I'd like to share this particular, I don't know, website or service, but it's called portableapps.com. And it's more than just a source of portable apps. It's actually a system that you can actually keep your apps and documents on your own keychain. The advantage of this is that you can use familiar Windows apps, or semi-familiar anyway, at least they're Windows apps, and environment. The other alternative is to have a bootable Linux USB key. The advantage of portableapps.com is you can run or test beta versions of different browsers. You can have your favorite fonts available. You can try out apps without having to, install later. So, I mean, these may be apps that you use all the time, or they maybe apps you just want to try. They're also good for emergencies because there are some apps on there that are virus checkers, various utilities, and editors. Editors not only of text, but also of a database or a thesaurus or dictionary. So there's a lot of useful information there. Also, the advantage of portableapps.com versus, you know, just doing rolling your own with your own portable apps. First of all, it organizes apps into categories. It can automate the updates when you start it up. It will ask if you want to update the programs that you have stored on your USB key. It's easy to find and start apps. You can have your favorite fonts available. And there are 450-plus apps that are accessible that Portable Apps has supported directly. Starting with accessibility apps. Mbella Bulka can read text aloud or save to an audio file. DICOM, DSpeech, NVDA, on-screen keyboard, virtual magnifying glass. These are things that you might like to use. If you have this on your USB key, you may bring it along with you. And if someone has a problem with their computer, you can plug that in, and then you have these apps available. Other apps, various editors, text, databases, web, Acopad, CPP check, database browser. There's a whole bunch of stuff here. Notepad++, which is a very powerful text editor. There are various others, Composer. This is a way to actually install or edit a web page with Composer, so you can update that. So even if you're not home, you don't have your computer, you could do this on somebody else's computer. And apps.com installer, SQLite man, there are a variety of other editors that come with portableapps.com, and you can choose one or more of those to store on your USB key. And it also comes with a whole bunch of information resources. ARTHA, BP Bible, are you into Genesis? Here's your chance to look at that again whenever you have a computer available. Braid Workshop, Celestia, Fremat, Golden Dick, Gramps, Marble, MemoSign, Sulfate, Stellarium is a very powerful way to look at the sky to see what's up there, how does it look, and this is available, and the latest version of it can be on your USB key, so you can see where the stars are aligned, and you can see what is accessible from where you are currently at this particular time. You can also type faster. You can learn how to touch type better. And all the others. There's a variety of games. Brave, Atomic Tank, Cannonball, Chromium, Monster 2, NetHack, Pathological, SuperTux, USB Sudoku. Wow, who doesn't like Sudoku? Warzone 2100, W Atomic, Chess, Wisnik, Zazz. So if you're interested in games and you're visiting someone and you have this on your keychain, you could wander off into some room with a PC and just play games while everybody else parties and has fun. It also has a variety of different programs for graphics and pictures. The ones that I've highlighted here, GIMP and UrfanView, are ones I've used all the time to be able to edit pictures in different ways. But there's other things here, Paint.net, Pencil Project, Photo Demon. I also use ShareX very regularly, but that's more of something you actually want to have on your own computer, so that you can screen capture. RAW therapy will allow you to look at raw images and convert them into other formats that are available that you can make pictures of. But all of these are available. All of these are available in portableapps.com. There's also internet apps, MSN, FileZilla, Free Download Manager, Google Chrome, Kitty, Telnet, SSH, Opera, Composer, BitTorrent, Telegram, WinSCP. There's a variety of choices here. You don't have to have them all on your USB key. Choose the ones that you really like and have them available, mostly in case your friends have problems. Or if you just want some music or some video, there's other apps as well. Audacity is a really good audio editor. Lame, Media Player, different media players. Shotcut, which I think was covered in previous OPCUG programs. VLC, which is good for being able to play a whole bunch of stuff. And there's all of these are available. But let's get down to business. What more do you need for business than Apache OpenOffice or perhaps LibreOffice, which is much the same? BabelPad, Caliber for ebooks. There's a whole bunch of things here. Foxit Reader, for PDFs, P-Notes, PDF editors, Scribus for desktop publishing. I just published the newsletter using Scribus, and it's available here on the USB key. Siegel Zoomit, which is useful for being able to show people things. And Zotero, which is mainly useful for if you're researching a variety of academic papers. Zotero will help you do that. But there's not just kind of ordinary stuff. There's also security stuff. ClamWin, there's the eraser stuff. Hijack this. These are checks for hijacks. KeePass, Kaspersky, MSS, Safety Scanner, Password Gorilla, SpyBot. All of these, and Veracrypt, all of these are useful for helping improve your security. So you can use them basically to fix somebody else's computer. But you can also just use them to try them out, see what happens. See what they can do. There are also some utilities, a lot of utilities. RegShot, RegAlyzer, GPUZ, GhostScript, HWInfo. There's a whole bunch of things. Altered Refrag, Wise Disk Cleaner. There's a bunch of stuff. So how does it work? Well, you install it on your computer. And then you install it on your USB key. And this could be a USB key that says, I'm using a 64 kilobyte USB key, but that depends on how much you put on it, how useful it is. And I just enter dstart.exe. And what it does first is it gives me the option to update stuff. Based on what I currently have on my USB key. In this case, I have 15 different programs that need updating, so I'm updating the 10th of these. And it just downloads them to your personal hard disk, and then it updates it on the USB key after that. After that, or if you don't choose to update, you get this page here, which is a whole bunch of stuff, and it's organized by the organization that I showed before. Accessibility, development, which I called editors, education, which I called information resources. And you can choose each of these. You can page through them. You can type in your choice of program here, and it will bring it up immediately. Also, on your USB key, there is a documents folder, a music folder, a pictures folder, and a videos folder. All of those are available for you to save stuff in. And on my USB key, which I have, I don't know, if not 415, probably 350 of those programs, I have about half of it available for data, for documents, music, pictures, videos, whatever. And it's all available for you. So, one thing that is required is that you need to turn off ASLR because it's using NSIS, an old version, which is being used in Windows. And so you need to turn off a bit of security. Now, this is the mandatory ASLR, and I've turned it off. So that's one thing that's required. But this is portable apps. So why keep your apps and your documents on your keychain? First of all, they're familiar. It's not a bootable Linux, which no doubt Alan will promote. But it allows you to run and test beta versions of browsers. The Google and the Opera browsers, you have choices of the beta versions of those. You can put your favorite fonts there so that if you need to bring your fonts to someone to add into their particular Word document or whatever, they're there. You can also use it for emergencies. It has virus checkers, different utilities to fix things, as editors. Basically, it's a Swiss Army knife USB key. So that's why I suggest portable apps might be a useful download for you.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. And I'm now going to...
Just before you do, Chris.
Yep.
Just before you do, there is a question for Tom.
Yep.
Edward wants to know, are all these apps kept current?
Yes, they are. They are kept current. Whenever you do that start.exe, you're prompted to keep them current. You can update them right away, or you can skip that if you want. But yes, they're all the most current versions.
Okay, I'm now going to unmute all. Well, I can't unmute people, so all I can do is mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. So I'm doing that now, and Tom, you'll have to unmute yourself again. If anybody has any questions or comments, you could unmute yourself and say it audibly or continue to use the chat. Tom, I had one question actually on the, you know, you say you have to disable ASLR. Could you talk at all to, presumably there's a reason why Microsoft has this in place. What's the danger of disabling that?
I'm not, ASLR is basically it moves stuff around so that you do not have all of your programs in a predictable space, like predictable address range. So that I forget what ASLR stands for, but that's basically what it means. It moves stuff around in your address space so that it does not it is not kind of immediately available for any kind of bad actors to go in and start changing stuff within that address space.
So I presume then if you're on, you know, a friend's computer and you want to use this, you would disable that. Presumably it'd be a good idea to re-enable that after you're done, because I'm guessing there are some potential vulnerabilities in leaving that disabled, right?
ASLR is not a default. You actually have to choose to enable it.
Oh, okay.
In your Windows thing, and I had it enabled, but the problem is that this portalapps.com uses a program to actually set them up so that you can update them and launch them from portalapps.com from start.exe, and they're using an old version of what's a program called NSIS. I don't know what that is. But apparently it is not compatible with ASLR, and so I disabled it for my computer so that I can start these apps. I don't get an error.
Okay, but if it's not a default, then it's not likely to impact other people. They won't have it enabled in all likelihood.
It's quite likely unless they're kind of geeks like me.
Okay.
He's asking, Tom, are those apps a mixture of 32 and 64-bit?
I'm not sure. I don't know. For example, Irfan for You comes in 32-bit and 64-bit versions. I'm presuming they're 32-bit versions mostly, but I really don't know.
Okay. And I think that's all the questions that we have currently. So we will have a question and answer session at the end as well, where I'll unmute people or allow you to unmute yourself. So right now I think we'll continue on. So I'm going to mute all. And again, you will not have the ability to actually, I'm just going to leave it. The people can unmute themselves, but please hold off on any comment or questions on that until after each of the presentations. But rather than doing this mute all and having to force everybody to unmute themselves, I'll just leave it. You can unmute yourself from now on. So our next presenter is Stuart Bruce, and he's going to talk to us about Google Wallet. Take it away, Bruce. Stuart, sorry.
I'm used to it. It's okay. Nobody gets my name right, even my parents.
Well, don't stew about it.
I'm in Quebec. We ragu. So Google Wallet, the digital world is here now. Has anybody got memories of being stuck at the cashier line waiting for somebody to count out all their pennies? Those days. Hopefully they're gone. They've been replaced by people trying to remember the PIN for their card. Well, Google Wallet's going to do away with that too. If people can find the thumb and unlock their phone, they should be able to pay for things a little more expeditiously than we have in the past. No promises. But that's sort of the concept, especially in these days where people have multiple payment cards. You can put them all in your phone now. And depending on what country you're in, you can do different things. So to use this, first you have to get the app. And, of course, Google Wallet, Google Play Store. Why don't we try the next slide? Maybe it'll help me remember what I'm talking about. There we go. Yes. Go to the Play Store and install the app. Then you go slap your face up in the right-hand corner, and that should give you a bunch of menu items. The important thing here is to go into the tips section, find participating banks, and see if you can actually use the payment method you want to use with the Google Wallet. Because in Canada, we have a variety of banks and credit unions and whatever. And not all of them work. And have their own, some have one card or another card, and most of them will work with Google Wallet, but you better check and make sure first. Once you've found out that you can use your card, well, you're going to have to install it. And that usually just means taking a picture of it, both sides, and then plugging in things like the expiry date. And there's a, I think it's called a CVS code. The app will walk you through the installation pretty simply. Bear with me, folks. I'm trying to remember because I've switched to an iPhone and I'm not even using the Google Wallet anymore. So I'm trying to remember this all. But it was pretty simple when I did it. Once you've plugged in the information for your card, the bank will be contacted by Google and they will do a validation and you'll get some sort of a notification by a method of your choosing, whether it's a text message or a phone call or an email, or even maybe carrier pigeon if you're really old school. And then they validate you exist and it's your card and your wallet and your bank says, yes, I trust this schmuck. And off you go to the races. You're ready to go shopping. Hopefully. Now you've done that. If you have more cards, plug them in. You never know. In my case, I wasn't able to use one credit card at a certain chain of stores. I don't know why. The physical card itself worked just fine, but the card in the Google Wallet would not. What can I say? Stuff happens. I don't have the same problem with that card and that chain of stores with the Apple Wallet, but I'm not trying to promote Apple phones or anything like that. No. Not to this group. I value my existence. Now, I think the biggest problem most people with a touch of gray in their hair has about using a digital wallet is the security. And in the slide here, we've got a link to a little article on Mobile Syrup that talks about whether it is secure or not. And they pretty much confirm that, yeah, you don't have to panic or worry about it. You can safely do this because most of the world is doing this now. There's really no concerns. And if you really are concerned, you can keep in mind that to make a payment, your phone has to have near-field communication and it has to be turned on. So if you're real paranoid or just being cautious the first little while, you can just leave the near-field communication radio off. And you just activate it when you're going to make a purchase, and you turn it off as soon as you've made the purchase and your phone has said, Yahoo, I just paid you, or him, or her, or whatever. No radio, no communication, your money stays in your phone. So that's the safest way of keeping things out of the hands of people. You don't want to have it. You don't want to have it. Excuse me. English is my first language, and I'm not very good at it. So once you have these all these cards in there, too, there's one other thing. They'll be stacked like a deck, you know, playing cards. And your default card is the one that's on top. You get to choose that, by the way. And it'll always be on top. But if you, for some reason, want to use a different card, you just drag your finger along the deck of cards in your on your screen, and the one that comes up on top, you just keep dragging your finger on it. And when you get the one you want on top and put it on the terminal to make a payment, that's the card that will be used. So it's very simple to use multiple cards. Now, at the same time, you can use loyalty cards in this, so you don't have to carry around all your store cards, you know, the PC Optimum and the Shoppers Drug Mart and whatever, you know, there's a billion of them. Google Wallet will take all of them quite well also. Now, interestingly, Tom made the comment, too, that if you're using a loyalty card that is essentially just a barcode, you could not put it in the wallet. You could just take a picture of it and set up a folder in Google Photos, and when it comes time to flash your barcode, show the picture of that card. So if your phone doesn't have near-field communication and you still want to use the and you don't want to install the wallet, but you want to use loyalty cards, you could do it that way. I may be sounding a little confused here, but going back to the phone without near-field communication, you could use the wallet just with loyalty cards. You can't make payments, but you can flash a barcode in it. So that's another function of the wallet.
Yeah,
is everyone confused yet?
Does that work the same way that you have a bunch of different cards shown on the screen and you can just pull one out with your finger?
Pretty much. I forget exactly, but you will have, yes, how's that? I forget. But I think the way it works is your payment cards are on top because that's kind of the default, and you drag your finger up from the bottom and you'll see the other cards stacked up underneath.
What's the benefit to Google to actually do this? I presume that you're not paying any extra to use Google Wallet. Are they getting a cut or something out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. Every time you use your card, I'm getting a cut. No, it's a convenience factor and helps people get into the Google ecosystem and use their other products that they use to get into your life with. It adds a level of security. There's something about an artificial number being generated to make the purchase so that even the vendor doesn't know which card you're using. So there's that extra layer of security. And the information is all in your Google Wallet, so you can check your purchases and payments. And if you want to do that, all that information is in there as well. I never did. That was just far too organized for someone like me. I always made a point of asking for the paper receipt anyway. But
so Micheline's asking, how does the phone know it's you and not someone else?
Well, how does any phone know it's you and not someone else?
How does your front door lock know that it's you that is putting the key in your front door?
Yeah, you have to
it's
be
up
able
to you
to
secure things. Yeah, it's up to you to secure things, yeah.
Yeah. I know with my iPhone, even after I've unlocked it and then gotten into my Apple Wallet and I put the phone on the terminal to make the purchase, I still have to lay my thumbprint on the sensor to validate that purchase each time. I'm not sure if the Google Wallet has that feature yet or as well or whatever, but there's so many layers of security that it's pretty straightforward.
Karen's asking if you can use this Google Wallet in other countries.
Yes. And you can do more in other countries. You can put boarding passes for airlines and subways and trains in your Google Wallet. You can't do any of that stuff in Canada. You wouldn't believe what you can do in Europe and Japan and China and even the United States, but you can't do it here.
I think you can use a smartphone with OC Transport on the
I was reading something about something in Ontario just the other day coming in, so it's progressing. Yes, it is progressing.
What if your phone's stolen? Is the information stored in the cloud or is it local to your phone?
I don't know.
And is there a search feature on the wallet?
For what?
Searching for a particular card, I guess.
Optimum card amongst the 75,000 cards you have in your Google Wallet.
I don't know. That's just carrying way too many cards for my imagination to comprehend. I've got a chat window on this screen here, and I noticed Serge Eric talking about Stocard, and I did want to throw in a little comment. I've been using Stocard, and I recommended it a couple weeks ago because I can't put all my loyalty cards in my Apple Wallet. So I started using Stocard, and it was pretty good until I noticed it was eating more cellular data than any other app on my phone. I said, wow, I mean, GasBuddy used to be a real data muncher, but Stocard was really chewing it up. So I deactivated cellular access for that particular app, and it still works. I mean, I can still use the app and show the card with the barcode and have it work. But Stocard can't go out and use my data to share my location with whoever it's sharing with. So if anyone's using Stocard and has a way of tracking how much data their device is using, you might want to check into how much is being eaten up by that particular app. I was quite surprised. So anyone can use your phone and steal all your money. Yeah, yeah. They can take my money and they can take my debt too.
Well, I guess the point is if you leave your phone unsecured, yes, of course people could
steal things. Yes, like an Interbank card or bank card.
Yeah, if you leave your physical wallet lying around, anybody could steal your money there too.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Last year I found a really nice looking world-class MasterCard on the floor in Giant Tiger. I was tempted, I'll tell you. Oh, three groceries for that day. But I found the manager.
Okay, I think that we've covered off all of the questions. If we missed any, by all means, chime in again. So thank you very much, Stuart. Very good. And some people think about whether that will be a convenience factor for them as opposed to a security nightmare. And I guess the people who were talking about it being a security problem, by all means, I did paste into the end of the chat the URL for Is Google Wallet Secure? And so if you are concerned about it, you might want to read that article that Stuart came up with for the presentation. So I think with that, our next presenter is Alan. And so, Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I want to touch on going back to computer programming using AI, because there's been a lot of bad press about artificial intelligence, I think, recently. The world's going to come to an end because everybody's going to write malware and cheat on their exam papers and all kinds of wonderful things. But actually, there's a lot of good things. And one of the good things I've found is finding out about various programming options. And one of the nice things about these chatbots is that they will actually generate code for you in quite a few different languages, and especially languages that you don't know at all or very well, let's say. They're also good for scripting. So if you're using Windows batch command files or even PowerShell, they will do that. They'll write macro code for you for Visual Basic for applications, for Office apps, or LibreOffice Basic even. Now, they'll also generate HTML code for you if you want to do web pages. But interesting, one of the really neat things is that they also will debug and optimize code. So you can write spaghetti code and then ask one of these chatbots to basically optimize it for you. They say it will add comments so you can document your code. I haven't tried doing that. But it really is a powerful learning assistant. And so if you're using one of these object-oriented languages that you really don't know anything about, it's really, really nice to be able to type in something and have it play back code and basically give you step-by-step tutorial on how to do the task that you've basically set it with various snippets of code. So it's really quite neat. So there's lots of different chatbots out there. Some of the programming ones that I've looked at, the first one, of course, is ChatGPT. That was the granddaddy of these guys. And it still says that during the research preview stage, usage is free. And the URL there is there if you want to try it out. But now they have introduced ChatGPT Plus, which is a subscription plan. And right now they're asking $20 a month to get you better access, basically, to the chatbot. Now, whether that will become the permanent fix, I don't know. Google has recently released Bard, and it says it's going to help you with coding. Interestingly, it says it's an experiment, so it may give you inaccurate or inappropriate responses. And they say, join the wait list and try it for yourself. So I joined the wait list and it said, it's not supported in your country, go away and don't bother me. And then the other one is GitHub Copilot, which is actually developed by OpenAI, the people that develop chatbot, and Microsoft. Microsoft now owns GitHub, so you'll find that Copilot is Microsoft's chatbot that they're going to introduce into the Office suite, for example. The problem with this one is it only has a 30-day free trial, so I can't be bothered with things like that. All you need to do is set up a free GitHub account to use it, but you only get 30 days. And after that, they want $10 a month right now, which is too rich for my blood. So ChatGPT is the one I have been using because it was the first and it's the one I tried. And basically, again, you need to set up an account. Well, one of the interesting things you can do is when you go to their login screen, rather than signing up, you can actually just say log in, and it will give you the option to use a Google account. So if you're on the OPCUG members only forum using your Google account, you could use that to access chat. It's very, very convenient. And then once you're actually on the system, you basically get this box at the bottom which says what you want me to do. So you type something in. So for example, I said write a Windows batch file to clear the print queue. And it came back with some code. And if you remember Chris's discussion on print queue, stop the print queue a few weeks ago maybe, he said there were three important commands in his batch file that you needed, and I think those are the three commands right there. So
that's exactly it, yeah.
So it's, and remember, this thing it's not really generating code. What it's doing is it's going out to the Google search engine, finding all kinds of people that have said, do this, do that, and the other, and then playing some of this back to you. So you can get the same results generally from a search engine. But I must say, ChatGPT gives it you in quite a nice format. And then the other thing I mentioned you can do is PowerShell script. So I told it to give me a command shell and to give me the free space on drive D expressed in gigabytes. And if you remember, we had a presentation by Stefan Vichard, who was talking about PowerShell. And this is actually one of his examples. And in the blue window here, you can see the PowerShell command that Stefan suggested, and you can see it's using this get sim instance. It uses a where object command, and it does a calculation here of free space divided by 1 gigabyte. And then it told him how much space he had on his drive. So I told it to do the same thing, and this is the command I get right up here. And it's using a get ps drive command instead. It's still using that where object, and it's doing that 3 divided by 1 gigabyte. So it's essentially the same kind of command, just using some different functionality. But the answer is basically the same. When I run that command, it tells me, here's the PowerShell window, tells me I've got 12 gigabytes free on this partition. And if I look at the properties of this is my data drive, you see that I've got 12 gigabytes free according to Windows. So clearly things are working pretty well. All right, so let's move on to the main event here. I talked a little bit at the Q&A a while ago on a LibreOffice basic macro to help me create the index file for the Q&A topics. Well, I want to change that to Python. And so I asked it, write some Python code. I actually was much more specific than that. Well, first of all, let's take a look at what we were doing. Here's the basic index file. And you can see down the bottom corner here, I've got my LibreOffice basic macro. And the reason I've got that is every week I produce a simple text file, which has got a date, and then the list of topics at the Q&A session, and then some information on the files that we have available, which get posted to the web. So basically, I already have a Python script that massages this data and basically produces two sets of data. It produces some HTML code, and it creates a table, and the table has the topics and then links to the files, and that goes onto the website, and then it also produces the links in this kind of format, and that goes onto the Q&A page. So if you look at our website, on the Q&A page you'll find those three links to the most recent Q&A session, and if you go to the archives page you'll find a whole bunch of listings which are in the same tabular format, the topics and the associated links. So what I'd like to do is add the functionality for the index file to this Python script. So I only have to do one thing to generate everything at once. So the problem is, if you remember, I know how to read lines of text from a text file, but the problem is the ODT file isn't really a text file. It's a zip file, and the zip file has a whole bunch of files inside it, and one of them is an XML component which has the text for the document. So what you want to do is access that file and add the text. I want to add the text to the end of the document. So essentially that's what my macro is doing. When I run the macro, it goes to the text file, grabs this piece of data right here, and drops it down at the bottom of the text. So right now what I'd like to do is I'd like to change my LibreOffice basic macro. I'd like to create Python code that does the same thing. So the Python code, it has to open the ODT file. It has to read lines from my text file, the one that I produce weekly. It has to add those lines to the end of the ODT file, save the file, and then export it as PDF. Because what you see on the website is actually a PDF version of the LibreOffice document. So let's go to ChatGPT and we say, write a Python program to open an ODT file and add just one line of text, because if I know how to do one, I know how to do lots. Now add a line of text to the end of the file. So ChatGPT comes right back and it says, you can do this kind of stuff. And you notice it says, I want to use this ODFPY module. So that's a Python module, which is already available somewhere. And if you've done any Python programming, you know that what you have to do is go and find that thing on the web. And you will find the project file, and it will give you this command to install the Python code inside your Python system on your computer. And then the other thing that's interesting, the other thing that's useful is you have this copy code button here. So when you click on that, it takes all of this code right here and copies it to the Windows clipboard, and then you can basically drop it into an editor. So that's what I've done here. I've copied the text into Notepad++ actually. And then what I want to do is I want to change their example.odt into my file, which I'm calling test file. So I want to load this file, do some manipulation, and then save that file. So here's the file I'm playing with. This is my test file. So it's got kind of the right header and it's got some of the text. So what I want to do is I want to add this new line of text at the bottom of the file here. So I pull the Python code into my Python editor. This is an editor that allows me to run the code at the same time. I run the code, it finishes successfully. I open my ODT file, and here's my new line of text. So now I know how to get Python to play with the text. So now what I'd like to do is basically export that ODT file to a PDF file. So again, I do the same thing. I ask it to, how do I do that? And it says, well, you can use this thing called UnoConv library. So that again is some kind of Python library that's already available. And I played around with this thing for a little while and I couldn't get it to work. So I looked a bit more carefully at this thing where it existed, and it's on GitHub. And the first thing it tells me is that this package is deprecated. So it should actually work, but they're working on a brand new version. And once the brand new version is working, then this thing will go away. So in my view, that's the time to abort the exercise and go on to try something else. So we go back to ChatGPT and we try again. And this time it says, well, we're going to use the LibreOffice package itself. And we're going to use this program called SOffice.exe And we'll use that to convert it using this code right here. And I take a quick look at that code and I say, oh, I have a problem. Because that line right there, setting the LibreOffice path to USR bin, and that is not a Windows subdirectory. So what it's given me some Python code for use on a Linux file system. And so that doesn't work very well. But it's my problem, right? I didn't tell it I wanted Windows. I just said, give me some code to do it. And it assumed I must want Linux. I mean, it's a very wise chatbot, this. Anyway, now I have to be a bit more specific. I say, write a Python program to run in Windows 10 and convert the ODT to PDF. So now it gives me this this guy right here. And it says, note that the program assumes that LibreOffice is installed in the default directory, which is going to be this one. And if I run it headless, I don't get the graphical user interface. So let's pull that guy into, let's create a Python file with that code. And the important command is right here, build the command to convert the ODT to PDF. So it's got this command right here. And if you break it down, this LibreOffice DIR variable is the path to LibreOffice. If I give the headless switch, I'm not going to get a user interface. So it's going to do it in a Windows command window, essentially. And I won't have the opportunity to interact with it through LibreOffice. It will just do it automatically. The convert to PDF switch clearly converts the source code to a PDF file. Optionally, I can tell it where to store this PDF file. But I also have to specify the path to the source ODT file. So basically, I have to give it some of that stuff. So there's their directory command. Here's my path to my ODT file. Here's the PDF file I want. There's the command, which is using these different variables. So I run this command, and it says it can't do it because C program is not recognized as a command. So something in that code, which ChatGPT gave me, is faulty. So I could look at that for a long time and try to figure out what it is. But remember that ChatGPT is very clever. What we can do is we can use ChatGPT itself to debug its own code, or our code if we screwed up. So I say, debug the error message, this, and it says, well, the error seems to be related to this LibreOffice DIR variable not being properly formatted. It's got spaces, and that might be a problem with the command shell. And then it says, here's the updated code. You want to fix it, enclose it with in quotes. And so now it's given me a slightly different command here. And rather than trying to get your magnifying glass out to see what's going on, here's the original command line where it's building the command. And it's got the command in quotes here after the F. But what it needs is it needs the quotes to be inside quotes. So now the double quotes are inside a pair of single quotes. Pretty obscure stuff, but that's what ChatGPT gave me, so I'm willing to try again. So now I plug this new command with the double quoted command line here, and now it finishes with no errors. And so in theory, I should have my PDF file. So here's my original test file.odt in this folder, this test folder. And here's my test file.pdf, the output file. But you notice that it's not in the folder. It's actually in a subfolder called testfile.pdf, which I thought was a bit odd. But then I remembered that setting the path to the PDF file was optional. So if you look at the code, I told it to set the PDF to this thing, which I was thinking was a file. But of course, it decided that was going to be a folder to hold the file. So if I get rid of this line which sets the PDF, if I get rid of the optional output switch, then I just run the program again, run this revised program now. run the revised program, and now my source file is ODT, and my output file is PDF. And when I look at that PDF file, you'll see it looks very much like the original one, and it's added the line automatically, and then, or rather, it's taken the ODT file, which had the added line, and created a PDF file. Right, so the other thing that's interesting here, I said, was that you can use ChatGPT to optimize code. So here's a piece of spaghetti code, which I wrote as a kind of a quick and dirty conversion program. And basically, what I'm doing here, I've got 150,000 records of airbag deployment statuses in motor vehicle crashes. And the way the data is structured is that it says that the airbag is in the steering wheel hub. So that's the driver's frontal airbag. Or the airbag can be in the top instrument panel or the mid instrument panel. Well, that one is the front airbag for the right front passenger. So I don't really care where the airbag is. I'm interested more in what's the function of this airbag. It's a front, it's an airbag that provides frontal protection to an occupant, or it's an airbag that provides side impact protection for the torso, or it's a side curtain that provides head protection in the side impact. So I want to say if the airbag type is this or this or this, then just call it a front airbag and give me the deployment type. And the same for side airbags. So I've got a whole bunch of if this, this, and then I check this. Well, clearly, if it meets this criterion, it doesn't need to check these two things because it's already self-fulfilled. And the problem is there's like 9 airbag types here that I have to go through. So clearly that's not a very efficient way to do it, but it was going to be a one-off. I was only going to run this program once. I find it quicker to write if statements. And I run the program overnight. It takes an hour and a half or something to run, but I don't care because I'm running it overnight. But let's suppose I really want to optimize the code. So I can go to ChatGPT and I can say, optimize this code, and here's my spaghetti code, and what are you going to do? Well, the first thing it says is, well, there are several ways to do it. You can use a with statement to fix your assignments in the first place. And an interesting one, which I probably would have done anyway, is use a case statement. And so instead of all those if statements, use a case statement, select the airbag type. And if it's a steering wheel hub, an instrument panel or a mid instrument panel, then just set the deployment type. Or if the case is a door panel or a seat cushion or a seat back outboard, then set the deployment type. And this goes into column X, and this one goes into column Y, and so on. And the other thing, I use a do while loop. Instead of using do while, it suggests using a for loop because it says for loops run faster. So that's kind of interesting. And then out of the blue, it tells me you can also speed things up if you turn off screen updating. And this is especially a case if you're on one worksheet and then you have to go to a different worksheet and then come back to the first worksheet. When you're skipping around, the screen goes nuts. So it's really good to turn off screen updating while Excel is doing all this stuff. And you can also turn off recalculation so it doesn't have to do everything there and then. So that's actually quite useful in certain circumstances. However, all it's doing here is it's telling me, well, you could do this and you could do that. Another interesting thing you can do with ChatGPT is once you've got the answer, you've got this regenerate response button. If you click that, it will try again. So now it's giving me a second guess. Well, here's what you can do. You can use a for loop, you can use a with statement, but here's the optimized code, right? So now it's actually going to give me some real code that would do what I want. And you can see here's where it's using the with statement to do the first assignments. And then here's the select case statement to check out all the frontal airbags and side airbags and head curtains. And you can see that's very compact in terms of six lines or so to do all the three things, where I had, I don't know, 12 lines or something, or maybe even more. And if I take that program and actually run it, so this is now inside Excel, we're running Visual Basic for Applications. And when I run this program, you can see that it's reading the location of the airbag and the deployment type. And if it's a front airbag, it dumps it into column X. If it's a side airbag, it dumps it into column Y. And if it's a side curtain, then it dumps it into column Z. So this code that ChatGPT has created basically works perfectly. Really neat. So bottom line is, now I know how to write lines of text to an ODT file. I know how to save that ODT file and save it as a PDF file. And even better, I now know how to debug and optimize code in Python and VBA and all kinds of wonderful things. So if you have any interest in scripting and programming, this is a really useful tool to be able to do these kind of things on programming languages that you may not know an awful lot about. So that's my presentation. Chris, I don't know if there's anything in the chat.
I don't think there is. It may go back a little bit, but Tom had a question. Wouldn't if airbag type greater than null work? I'm not sure if that going back into your code there would really be worthwhile.
That would give me any airbag type to go where, though.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
All right, so I'm basically done. So.
Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. That was for back in the wallet type thing. So, yeah, I think that's it. So thanks very much, Alan. And if there are any other questions, we could take a couple of minutes right now. Or, again, we will have an opportunity after my presentation where we can people can ask or comment on anything that they've seen tonight. So I think I will go ahead. We just got a thumbs up from Sue Bruce. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and – oh, actually, hang on a second. I'm going to stop share. Share my whole screen. Okay, so what I wanted to show tonight was a nifty little program that maybe some people haven't come across called Quick Assist, and it allows for – fast, easy, and free remote assistance. And I'll be going into some detail about what that really means and why it's so fast and easy. So I'm going to ask Linda. Linda's unmuted, so I'm going to ask Linda to follow along with me. Have you ever had a conversation that went something like this? I can't get my file that my grandson emailed me.
Right-click the file name at the bottom of the message and choose Save As.
I don't see that.
Do you see a paperclip to the left of the message in the message list in the window above the preview pane?
I don't see anything called preview pane.
It doesn't actually say preview pane. It's just, oh, forget that. Open the message in its own window.
Okay. You want me to right-click and choose open link in new window?
Are you in Thunderbird or are you in a web browser?
I think I'm on the internet. So
yes,
this is the sort of conversation that you can sometimes have with somebody who's a neophyte, maybe. And I mean, ignorance is not a crime by any stretch of the imagination, but it can be a real problem when you're trying to help somebody out and you don't understand what they're trying to do. They don't really understand what you're asking them to do. And so it can make for a real problem when you can't see their screen, when you can't see what it is that they're actually doing. So enter Quick Assist. So it's a free program from Microsoft, and it runs on Windows 10 and 11. It allows you from two perspectives. So if you want, you can get help from somebody else by sharing your computer with that other person. And it'll allow that other person who's going to help you out to view what is on your screen so that they will know if you're in Thunderbird or if you're in a web browser, and what you're clicking on and what you're right-clicking on and things like that. It can also optionally allow the person who's helping you out not only to view your screen, but also actually take over your keyboard and mouse. Not just take it over, you still have control as well, but they can also control your keyboard and mouse so they can do things on your behalf. From the opposite perspective, it allows you that you can help other people with their PC problems. So you can view their screen. So you can also direct their attention by using on-screen annotations and a laser pointer that appears on their screen, and optionally allow you to operate their keyboard and mouse. And that always gets people a little bit worried that you can, use their keyboard and mouse. They have total control over whether that's allowed or not, and they can stop it at any point in time. Okay, so to run Quick Assist, you have to run it on both computers. It's the exact same program. And there's three ways, basically, that are the three most common ways that you would actually run it. If you press Windows Control Q, that will actually run Quick Assist. You can click the Start button and then just type in Quick Assist, and it'll come up in the results window, and you just click on it. Or you can go to the Start menu and you can go and find the program. If you're on Windows 10, it'll be in the Windows Accessories group. And if you're on Windows 11, you go to your All Apps and just go down to the Q section, and it'll be listed there. Now, there is a chance you might have to install it from the Microsoft Store. Okay, again, it is free, but if you're on an old version of Windows 10, Microsoft has changed Quick Assist, and so it may need to be updated before it'll successfully work. I think on Windows 11, you'll never have a problem with it, and if you're on recent version of Windows 10, probably you won't need to install it either. But if you have any problem on either of the two computers, just go to the Microsoft Store, and what you do is you just search for Microsoft Quick Assist, and you can see here it came up. Interestingly, it didn't come up as the first recommended app. Microsoft Photos, what it has to do with Microsoft Quick Assist, I have absolutely no idea, but you'll get a list of programs, most of them totally unrelated, like Microsoft Sticky Notes, but Microsoft Quick Assist should be in the list there somewhere. You click on that, and it'll come up with another screen, part of which will show in the left-hand panel, it'll show who published it. Make sure that it actually says it was published by Microsoft Corporation, that you don't accidentally get some other app that somehow came in there showing up as Quick Assist. So as long as you have the app that is published by Microsoft Corporation, that's the one to go for, install it, and you're good to go. Okay, so both ends have to run the app, and they will both get a screen that looks like this. Now, the person who is providing the assistance or the help, okay, they click on the button that says Help Someone. If you're not signed into Windows using a Microsoft account or the Microsoft Store using a Microsoft account, you will get prompted to sign into a Microsoft account. I'm not going to go into anything about how to do that. If you need that, just look up Google for how to get a Microsoft account if you need one. If you are signed into Windows using a Microsoft account, you won't get prompted at all, and you're good to go. Only the person who is actually providing assistance needs to be signed into a Microsoft account. The person who is getting help doesn't need a Microsoft account. Okay, so then the person who is providing the assistance will get a screen that includes a code to give to the other person. So it says, share the security code with the other person. Notice that the code expires in 10 minutes. So it's not good for lifetime or anything like that. You don't have to worry about this being used later on in a malicious manner or anything like that. So you get that code. Now, the other person who is getting assistance, what they do is they're just sitting at that, and they are on the prompt at the top of enter the code from the assistant. And so that's where you actually provide that code to them, MXM3NQ. They plug it in, and then they click on the submit button. Then the person who is giving assistance will see this spinning wheel, and it just says, waiting for the other person to accept your request. You can't force yourself to be able to see their screen or take over their computer or anything like that. They have to actually accept it. On their side, they'll actually see a screen that says, do you want to allow screen sharing? Okay, it tells you who it is that's trying to view your screen. And notice that it's just view your screen at this point. It's not taking over your keyboard and mouse. And then note this here. Remember to close anything that you don't want them to see. So get any sensitive information off your screen. If you have your passwords in open, you know, close them so that nobody's going to see that sensitive information. And then you click on the allow button. So then this is what the person who is getting help will actually see a toolbar at the top of their screen. Okay. If it's covering up something of importance later on or at any point, you can actually drag it to a different position on the screen just by dragging the title bar as you would any other window in Windows. The assistance provider will see the receiver's assistance receiver's desktop in a resizable window on there. So you can see here, my whole desktop is here. I've just blurred out the background of it. And I'm seeing the person that I'm giving help to, I'm seeing their desktop in this resizable window. The assistance provider will get a toolbar that just appears at the top of the window. Now, if we look at the toolbar that is actually on each of the screens, so the person who is getting assistance, they have this toolbar, and it has three options on it. So there's chat, pause sharing, and disconnect. So those are the three functions that they can actually do. I'm going to cover off what they do when I talk about the assistant provider's toolbar, because the assistant provider's toolbar will have all these three options plus more. So the person who is actually giving assistance, one of the things they can do is request control. And this is how you would gain access to the other person's keyboard and mouse. So you click on that, and then there will be a pop-up on the window of the person who's getting assistance. It'll say who it is requesting control, and they can allow or deny it. So presumably you want to allow them to do that. Oh, by the way, you're best doing this with a phone call at the same time. You don't absolutely have to. I'll show you later on how you can get around dealing with that. So if they click on allow, then that would give you, as a provider of assistance, the ability to control their mouse and keyboard. Now, the assistance receiver can cancel that control at any time. So if they see, you know, somebody's helping them out, and all of a sudden they see them doing weird things that they think, oh, I don't want them doing that, they can, in their toolbar, they have an option to cancel control, and that'll take it away. So the assistance provider, the person giving help, can also stop control at any time just by clicking on the stop control button. This can actually be useful because if you think about it, that I'm helping somebody else, my mouse is controlling their mouse. What if they start doing something on their computer and then I nudge my mouse? All of a sudden, I'm going to cause their mouse to move on the screen and things like that. So you may want to periodically stop control just to allow things that to operate a little bit more smoothly. Okay, the next option you have on there is a laser pointer. And this, again, is for the person who's giving assistance. You click on that, and you can select a color. And then when you move your mouse, it'll actually show this mouse trail type thing or a laser pointer go on the screen. So you can use this to sort of direct the person you're helping, say, oh, move over here, click on this, or whatever you need to do. And that'll actually work without even control of the mouse and keyboard, because you're not actually affecting anything on their computer. All you're doing is it shows up on their screen. So there's no real security issue around allowing this. The next one is annotation. And if you click on that, you can click on the little pen icon in the left, and it'll open up this panel that shows you different colors that you can choose from. And then you can click on the assist, the person's screen, and you can draw with the mouse. The difference between this and the laser pointer is that this stays on the screen, whereas the laser pointer is a thing. It just runs for about 2 seconds, and then it sort of goes away by itself. And if you want to get rid of all the annotations that are appearing on that person's screen, you can just click on the eraser. It'll remove all of the annotations you've done in that current session. And that, again, works even if you don't have control of the mouse and keyboard, because, again, there's nothing dangerous to it. There's nothing security-wise. You're not affecting anything on their computer other than just drawing on their screen. The next one over is Chatbox. And the assistant provider, the person giving assistance, it'll end up putting out the chatbot box over to the right of the person's desktop. And the person who's getting assistance, the chat box will just appear somewhere on their desktop. And then you can use the box to where it says send to type a message. You hit enter, and then it'll appear in the message received window. It'll end up appearing there. So you can type messages back and forth. This is most useful if you can't be on the phone at the same time. Or something like that, you might want to just chat messages back and forth rather than talking over the telephone. But believe me, it's a lot easier if you talk over the telephone. And then when the chat box is visible, you can just click the chat box button on the toolbar, and either the person giving assistance or the person getting assistance can do this. They can just click it, and it'll make the chat box disappear. You can also just click the X in the top right corner of the chat box. The next one over is Select Screen, and this is available only to the person who's giving assistance. You click on that, and it'll come up with a box asking you to select a monitor. And the thing is, if the person that you're giving assistance to has multiple monitors, you're able to choose any one monitor. They'll all be listed. Or you can choose all monitors. If you choose all monitors, every one of the monitors on their system will appear side by side on your screen. Next one over is actual size or fit to screen. And this gets really useful when you have a mismatch in the resolution of the screen between the person who's giving assistance and the person who's getting assistance. So if you have it at actual size, that's a pixel for pixel match between the two computers. So if the person who is getting help has a higher resolution screen than the person who's giving help, then the person who's giving help will only see part of their desktop at one point in time, and they'll have to use scroll bars to see other parts of it. Fit to screen will actually scale it so that the person's who's getting help, their entire desktop will always appear. But it might have to shrink things down, so the entire screen, things might be a little bit small. What I suggest on this, it is a toggle just between actual size or fit to screen. So just try the two settings and see which one works best for you as the person who is giving assistance. You might need to have that actual pixel for pixel to be able to see some detail, or you might be able to get by with things looking really small. Up to you. Next one over is Reconnect. And this is available to the person who's giving help. And if the session gets interrupted for any reason, you can try the reconnect, and it will try to reestablish the session without having to go through the keys, the codes again and things like that. I have found it rarely works. And typically I find that you actually have to restart Quick Assist on both sides and just go through the connection process again. Next one over is Restart, and this is available to the person who is giving help. And it allows you to restart the person who's getting help, restart their computer. Now, it's not going to just automatically do it. The person who's getting help will get a pop-up on the screen saying that, you know, your device is going to be rebooted, and you have 30-second countdown where they can actually abort it and say, no, I don't want you to reboot my computer. Next one over is a pause. And this can be very useful if, for example, the person who's getting help, if they have to step away from the computer and they don't want the other person to be able to snoop around while they're gone, or if you want to display some sensitive information, say you have to log into something and you want to look up a password or something like that, and you don't want the person who's giving you help to be able to see that, you can pause the screen and or pause the session, and then the screen will blank. And so it'll look sort of like this, where it just black out the screen, and then any pause session, it'll change to a play button on the toolbar where you can resume. And so if it's the person who is helping the other one pauses a session, either end can resume it. If the person who is receiving help pauses a session, only they can actually resume the session. Next one over is Task Manager, and this is available only to the person who's giving help. And all it does is it opens up Task Manager on the person who's getting help computer. No different than if you just right-click on that person's taskbar and choose Task Manager. Okay, so it just brings up Task Manager. I don't know why they thought that was worthy of putting into a button by itself, but they did. The last option is Leave, and this is both the person giving help and the person getting help. Both have this option. They can terminate the session at any time. Okay. All you do is click on Leave, and it'll kill the session. So just as an example, like the first example I had where Linda and I were chatting back and forth, that was where you're really wondering because, you know, somebody, well, they don't understand anything about computers, and they're talking in language that doesn't make sense to me, and what I talk to them about doesn't make sense to them, and it becomes really, really difficult. But there are circumstances where this is useful even when it's people that are very knowledgeable of what they're doing. It's just they're stuck with a particular issue that they want to be able to help, get help on. And I ran across this just recently. So get this question on the phone. When I select an object in one PowerPoint deck and I want to copy it to another deck, Windows won't let me copy it. I thought, okay, this person is experienced in PowerPoint. They know how to copy and move objects and things like that. They know how to create decks. They know how to edit decks. They know how to work in Windows. So it's a bit of a puzzle to me. I mean, PowerPoint definitely will allow you to copy objects from one deck to another deck. That's no problem. I do it all the time. So it's really difficult for me to determine why is copy and paste not working in this? Is the copy function not working? Is the paste function not working? Is it a corrupted PowerPoint deck? Is it something outside of PowerPoint that is causing this to be a problem? Now, I could work through this over the phone saying, well, you know, try this instead, try this instead. But why not just use Quick Assist? So on Quick Assist, I ask the person, show me what you're trying to do. So they clicked on this moving objects, create artifacts, and I could immediately see that what was happening was that they clicked within a text box. It wasn't just any object. It was actually a text box object. Within PowerPoint, if you click in the middle of a text box, it doesn't select the text box. It actually puts the insertion cursor in that text object so that you can edit the text in it. So any attempt to copy tried to copy text from within the text box, not the text box itself. No characters were actually selected. They just clicked on the word create. And so there's nothing to copy because you have nothing selected. And so that's why no copy function was actually working on in this case. The solution of it was really simple. Select the text box by clicking on the edge of the box, and then you're not within the box editing the text, and now you have the actual text box selected, and you're able to copy and paste that entire text box. It was real easy once I could see their screen. Much, much more difficult to figure out when I couldn't see their screen. So even with knowledgeable people, you could find that Quick Assist is a really handy tool to be able to sort out little oddball problems and things like that. So in summary, I think Quick Assist is a great program. It's free. It has almost all of the functions that I want and need. It is already on pretty much every Windows 10 and Windows 11 computer. So there's usually nothing to install. So it's really, really quite a nice program. I find it very easy to use. It's very simple. It's easy to get anybody up and running with it. So if I have somebody who who contacts me and says, I need help on my computer, no matter how much of a neophyte they might be, it's usually very, very quick and easy to get them up and running. Certainly much easier than walking through somebody installing a third-party app, something like TeamViewer, which is a very capable program as well, but it's just a little bit more convoluted to install it and work with it and things like that. There are two deficiencies to Quick Assist for me that I find a little bit annoying, but not really a huge deal. I would like, when I'm working with somebody else on a problem, it'd be nice if I could actually transfer files between the two computers without having to email it or something else. There is no file transfer capability built into Quick Assist. And the other thing that for me, when you looked at my screenshots of annotations and so forth, it was pretty rough circling of a thing on the screen. I do have a pen tablet, and it'd be really nice if I could actually use my pen for annotation and laser pointers, but unfortunately Quick Assist just doesn't seem to work with that. So that's it for Quick Assist.
You have one question in the in the queue there from Stu, and I think you've already answered it. Are there pros and cons to Quick Assist versus TeamViewer?
I don't think the TeamViewer allows file transfer either. And I don't know if it allows for pen use or annotation. So for me, it's all downsides to TeamViewer. One of the things that I found really annoying about TeamViewer is that if they decide at some point in time that you are using it for commercial purposes rather than just personal use, they will lock it and you will not be able to use it. And it's a very convoluted process you have to go through to convince them that, no, indeed, you are using it for personal use only, and then they'll unlock it, and it usually takes a couple of days for that to happen. Microsoft Quick Assist, they don't care who uses it. You know, it doesn't matter if it's in a commercial environment or not. That's one deficiency of TeamViewer is if you're in a commercial environment, you're not licensed to use it without paying money to TeamViewer people.
Another problem you can have, Chris, is that sometimes they update TeamViewer and sometimes it's not backward compatible.
Oh,
so you finally have to install a new version before you can actually talk to the other person.
Yeah, one thing that's good about TeamViewer is it's cross-platform. So they do have a Mac client. I don't know if they have a Linux client.
Yes, they do, I think.
They do, yeah.
Yes, so if you,
if you do have to work cross-platform, TeamViewer or something like that would be a good thing. Quick Assist is strictly Windows 10, Windows 11. That's it. So I think being in this group, in most cases, Quick Assist is going to work for you. Certainly if somebody called me up and wanted help on my Mac, I would tell them, get a Windows computer and call me back because I can't help you with a Mac computer, I'm afraid. So
I think the biggest things you said were, it's already part of Windows, so it's right there.
Yeah.
And TeamViewer can be a bit of a so-and-so to install, so.
Yeah, and they really do want to convince you to pay money, too, because it is a commercial enterprise, you know, the TeamViewer people. And so they really do want you to use features that are only available to those that pay money.
I'll just raise a point. Like, Chris is picturing somebody having problems with the Mac and asking Chris to help with those problems. But I've used TeamViewer when somebody had a Mac because they want help with Photoscape Mac environment, or it works in Windows environment, and it looks the same, so I can help them out even though I'm not Mac. The program looks identical, so I can use the Quick Assist. But one more thing I'll quickly mention: when Chris was talking about giving up control of the mouse because you might hit it by mistake when the other person's using the mouse, the thing that happens most often, I think, is, you know, he's on my computer and maybe we've got some sort of error message. He goes to Google the error message, and that means he's moving his mouse to go punch in the error message and to Google to do a search. So it's that kind of thing. It's very easy to have that happen.
Yeah, we found in our remote sessions like this that often it's best if I don't have control unless I need it. And I'll just direct Linda, go click on this, or I'll say, oh, this is probably easier for me to do. Let me ask for control, get it. I'll do whatever I have to, and then I give up that control so that we don't have her mouse moving around erratically.
So Jeff has a question, if there's any time limit on the session, on the quick assist session.
Not that I'm aware of. I've certainly never run into it. I've probably run quick assist sessions that ran well over half an hour. I've certainly never seen something coming up saying that there's any limitation or that it's about to end or anything like that, which I guess is actually a bit of a concern as well. It is awful easy when you're doing a quick assist to forget that this person is connected to your computer. And then you say, oh, okay, thanks very much for your help. You hang up the phone, and then you go back to using your computer. And they maybe get up and wander off or something like that. And they come back and they are still seeing your screen. So, you know, if you're doing sensitive things or something like that, maybe they're able to see things that maybe you don't want them to be able to see. So I really recommend that keep in mind that until somebody clicks on that end session, the person is able to, at a minimum, view your screen. So make sure you do end the session when you're done with the quick assist that you need done.
Chris, this is Karen. I was just going to say that when you and I have done quick assist, we find that it affects my keyboard as well.
Yeah, it the biggest thing that can happen, because you really are controlling the keyboard, so things like numlock state or caps lock state and things like that will actually transfer across. And I think that where that can come into play mostly, or more so than other things, is on a laptop. Often you don't want the numlock state on if you have an embedded numeric keypad. And so just realize that, yes, there are things that if you're controlling the keyboard and the mouse, the state of the person who's giving help, the state of their keyboard and mouse is going to affect the state of the keyboard and mouse of the person who's getting help. So probably another good reason to only take control when you actually really need to have that control, and then give it up when you no longer need it, even if you're still helping the person and just directing them. So good point, Karen. Yeah, thanks. Any other questions? Okay, I think I will do a stop the share then. So we are just past the 9, but I think at this point in time, happy to open it up for any other general questions or comments. If anybody has anything, you know, you can either put it in the chat or unmute yourself and say it audibly. Yeah. Oh, actually, that's interesting. Jocelyn says, can also be fun if your mouse is left-handed and they're right-handed. Yes. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. You're changing the state of the other person's keyboard and mouse, potentially. So, yeah, watch for those things. Another great reason why you don't want to have it in control all the time. Okay, as Alan mentioned in the chat, there's no Q&A tonight, as it's regular meeting night. We don't have Q&A on regular meeting nights. We do have a couple of things in the queue for next week's Q&A on May 17th, but not a lot. So if you have any question or something you want to share with the group, by all means, send it into the suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll reserve time for you in the session on May 17th. I think with that, I would like to thank everybody who took the time to present to the membership. I hope everybody found something that was of interest to them. And even if you're not going to necessarily do it, just knowing that the capabilities are there is sometimes a wonderful thing in and of itself. So thanks very much, folks, and hope to see you all at next week's Q&A.
There's a good comment there from Jeff. He wondered, why do you need a left-handed mouse? He says, there's no left-handed pianos for left-handed people.
Good point. And for anybody still on the call, think about our next Q&A. We try to have these a couple of times a year. think about something you would like to share with the group. And it doesn't have to be – sorry?
Member's favorite.
Member's favorite. Yeah, sorry. Member's favorite. 10 to 15 minute presentation. We can help you put together a deck if you need it. If you just want to demo something, that's great. It's nice to share what we do know with other people who maybe haven't used something that you find useful. So keep it in mind. We'll probably have another one of these in the fall sometime, and we'll be putting out a call for participation.